Let's go ahead and get started. I hope you all had a nice break and fun taking the exam. It is graded, and I will have much more to say to you at the end of class. Actually, if you think to give me a 10-minute warning, I'd appreciate it. Just stop me from whatever I'm doing, and I'll talk to you about the exam and get back to you. The grades are on Blackboard, but they're invisible to you right now. I was going to wait until after the class. And the reason I do that is because I don't really want you worrying about numerical grades until you see the spread and listen to my interpretation of what you should think about the grade, as opposed to fretting over some numerical grade. The mean was 69, the median was 71. So not really that untypical for my exams. Anyway, so we'll talk more about that later. There is a problem set due Friday. Sorry for the confusion. I was frantically trying to get something on the web before I took off for an airport, and I got the date wrong. So anyway, also workshops next week. So technically, did the last week's lecture slides and audio go okay? All right. So I'm going to basically assume that you listened in on that. So if you didn't, you'll want to do that, and then you may want to look again at what we do today.
Obviously, I'll review some of what we did, but it's going to go sort of fast today,
the stuff that we talked about last week. So we started talking about friction last week. And so friction is a real-world force that we really can't avoid in this business. And interestingly, in essence, it's actually quite complicated. It's the interaction between two surfaces. And it might depend both on the surface shapes, and so how rough they are in principle, but also maybe chemical adherence and things like that. So it's a complicated thing in the real world. And but the truth is, in most realms it's relatively simple to describe. The friction between two surfaces is greater if they're pressed harder against one another, and if the normal force, the physicist would say, is greater. And also, the frictional force between the two surfaces will depend on the nature of the surfaces. And so we put that information, if the surfaces are sliding, so you have an object sliding on another surface, then we say that the force of the friction is equal to a constant times mu sub k. Constant is the coefficient of kinetic friction. Kinetic meaning it's moving. This constant quantifies in some way the nature of these two surfaces. If they're very sticky, then this is a very big constant because you have to have a big friction force. If the surfaces are Teflon, then it's going to slide very easily and the force of friction will be small. So mu sub k will be small. So somewhere there's some poor geek that's sitting around measuring these mu sub k's and putting them in tables for you to use in principle. Then the normal force, remember, is the force at right angles between where these two surfaces meet. So the normal force on this mass is equal to the force of the floor on the mass, which if the mass isn't flying up or crashing through the floor, you know it has to be equal to mg going down because the net forces have to be zero going in place because it's not accelerating. So the normal force quantifies how much they press against each other. Bigger normal force, you'll have more friction. So it's a pretty simple thing. If you push something that is at rest, it's sort of hard to get it going. And then once it starts to go, it's easier to slide. And so physically what's happening is you might have more adherence, things getting stuck between the two surfaces, until you get it moving. And then once it's sliding, things really are a little bit looser. And so there is a friction force that is larger when the two objects are at rest with respect to one another. And we quantify that difference by putting a different constant here, everything else being sort of the same. But there's a problem with this because it's not moving. And so if you have a box like this that's sitting here, it's not moving and I'm not pushing on it. What's the frictional force on it? I could give you mu sub s, but there is no frictional force on it. Because it's not, if there were, it would be accelerating somewhere because there's no other force on it. If I began to push on it, then it would go because there would be a net force, except there's a frictional force that opposes it. And that's why it doesn't go anywhere. If I push a little bit harder, that frictional force increases. And it will continue to increase until I just reach a threshold value where it goes. And that threshold value is the maximal frictional force you can have if you have a static situation. And that is what's given by this mu sub s times n. You don't know a priori what the force of static friction is. What you know, what you quantify here, is that threshold value. So you will find some very awkward wording in all of the problems, such as, calculate the maximum value that such and such a thing can be before it begins to move, or calculate such and such in the condition where it just begins to slip. And so those little just begin to slip type words are the things that are telling you that you want to be using this threshold value. But that is a subtlety, and you really want to watch out for that one. In terms of direction, basically the force of friction will oppose the motion, or it will oppose the net force other than friction on the object in order to give you acceleration of zero. And it is not necessarily always obvious in a problem. As we get to more complex problems, sometimes you won't actually know what direction the net force is on some surface, and you'll have to assume one and then work it out accordingly. And what you'll find is that you'll get a negative value for that force if it turned out you assumed the wrong direction. Any questions about friction? Okay. All right, so we have here, imagine that we have a mass which is at rest on an inclined plane, and that we have an angle theta. Friction is present. Let's say that between these two surfaces, you have a mu sub s or a mu sub k. And what I would like you to do is to think about this for a moment, and if it were me, I would probably have to sketch on a piece of paper a little bit. But I want you to consider whether the magnitude of the force of friction would be given by which of those five expressions. Close your eyes, if you will, and all of those who think number one, raise your hand. Number two. Number three. Number four. Number five. Okay, so
Well, I saw about one, two, 30-ish, and probably a bunch who didn't raise their hands. So, to think this one through, you want to think about the free body diagram. You have mg down, you have a normal force on the thing, and it would slide down if it could. It's not, I'll tell you it's not, so there must be a force of friction. And then you have the two components of this mg. You have mg sine theta, mg cosine theta here, and mg sine theta here. These two forces have to cancel each other out because the acceleration is zero. It's not crashing into the inclined plane, it's not flying up in the air. So that means that n is equal to mg cosine theta. These two forces also have to cancel out because I tell you it's at rest, which means mg sine theta is equal to force of friction, which is the answer. Now, maybe it's the answer, because this one actually I needed to give you numbers to really specify. Because you could take it another step. You could say, well, what is the maximal value this coefficient of static friction could be? And if I asked you that, you could find that it's mu sub s times n, and mu sub s times n would be this value. N is mg cosine theta, so you could have mu sub s times mg cosine theta would be the maximal value the force of friction could be, and have this thing at rest. Okay? So, if I set it up so that this mass and mu's are such that this value is all, how do I say this? Such that the force you would need to balance, that is, if this mg sine theta is less than this, then in fact the force of friction is only going to be that much. It will not be the maximal value. So often in these kinds of problems, you really have to look at the problem assuming it is the greatest it can be at the maximal value. And then you need to look at the problem sort of without that. And you need to compare those values, right? And if it's not moving, the force of friction on it will be as small as it has to be to basically hold the thing in place. Okay? So, watch that subtlety. So, to me, the answer here is really one or two, depending on exactly how the problem is set up. But always watch out for that kind of trick. Any questions?
Okay, so another thing that we talked about last week was circular motion.
So let me ask you a question. We have, let us suppose that this is an horizontal plane that's projected up on the board. And basically a rock is being slung around in a circle. And the string gets cut at one point when the rock is at this point. Okay? Which path is this rock most likely to follow? All of those who think one, two, three, four. Okay. The thing to remember about circular motion is that in order for something to go in a circle, the velocity has to be changing. Its magnitude will be the same as it goes around the circle, but its direction has to change, which means that's an acceleration, because acceleration is a changing velocity with respect to time. So the thing that makes something stay on a circle is that you have a constant rate of change for the velocity vector toward the center. That is a constant acceleration toward the center. If you remove that acceleration,
In this case, that acceleration is provided by the string. If you cut the string, you're removing the thing that's pulling on it, that's giving you the force that gives the acceleration toward the center. And it will just continue via Newton's first law, an object in motion remains in motion unless acted on by a force, which means the moment you remove that force, it just goes in a straight line. Okay?
So, I think in the lecture last week, I probably did a bit of a hand-waving argument to justify the size of that acceleration. But basically, this acceleration, which is often given the substrate C, we call it centripetal acceleration. Centripetal goes as the magnitude of this tangential velocity squared over R. And the force is the mass times that acceleration. And that would be the force that it takes to keep the object moving toward the center. So, a few things. How many of you have ever heard of centrifugal force? Forget you ever heard of it. People who make centrifuges really do a disservice to us in the physics world. Very briefly, if you were to go in a coordinate system which is rotating with this object around the circle, okay, you're sitting on the rock as it's going around the circle, and your coordinate system is along the perpendicular to the circle and tangent to the circle. Since you're moving with the rock, you don't really think of yourself going around in a circle, right? Because you're moving with the rock. So you're like on the merry-go-round itself. The problem is, if that's your coordinate system, you feel a force pulling you outward. The rock has a force that basically feels like it's pulling out. There's tension in the rope. Okay? If you're in that coordinate system, you call that force, which is a fictitious force in a sense, it's not real. In that circular coordinate system, you call that a centrifugal force. Okay? Having said all that, that's all I'm ever going to say about it except forget it. Okay? In this course, I don't want you thinking about centrifugal force because it literally is a force within a particular coordinate system that you put in there to make things work. But it's not really very intuitive and it's not really a correct way of looking at it. What you want to do is only look at circular problems from the outside where you see the object, it would be going in a straight line except it has something always pulling it toward the center. And that is what we call the centripetal force. And that's how I want you to think about this kind of problem. Okay? So the way to think about a centrifuge is that you have this arm that is moving with whatever the liquid is or whatever, and as it moves, the arm has a tension in it or whatever that is constantly pulling that thing toward the center. Okay? And that's basically how it works. A way to think about it is what you're doing is you're separating, you know, things that are slightly heavier from things that are not, basically, the centrifugal, things that have more mass, particles that have more mass. So the way to think about that is the centripetal force that's necessary to keep the same radius at the same velocity is going to have a dependence on the mass. So it's going to end up meaning that things that are have more mass will sort of sink toward, will push to a greater radius where the normal force pushing on them has to be larger. Anyway, you're going to have circular motion out the wazoo. So you really need to be thinking. You need a mantra. If you see the word circle, you need to think F equals mv squared over r. Okay? If you see F equals mv squared over r, you need to think that is a circle. Okay?
If I say circle, you go F equals MV squared over R. And it is okay if you do that on a test. I'm absolutely okay with that. In any problem where the word circle is used, F equals MV squared over R is a valid equation. And you will want to use it. Because if it is a circle and you don't use it, the probability of you getting that problem is probably zero. Okay? So, please, that should be automatic. It's not even hard to remember. So do that. Any questions on circles? Ah, there is something else I want to tell you. Circles, circular motion is pretty simple to understand because when you see circle, you go F equals MV squared over R, and that's easy. Motion where something just moves in some sort of curvilinear fashion, right? Like a car on a road, that's very complicated, right? But if you think about what's happening at any instant of that motion, you could imagine that at some instant, even though it's a more complex curve, you could approximate the motion for a small enough region of arc length as a circle. So that means even for complicated curved linear motion at some level, for small enough sections of that motion, you can understand the forces of it. So circular motion is more powerful than maybe it sounds. And so you won't see this kind of, you won't have to invoke this kind of thing all that often, but you may see that kind of thing. Okay, so we also last time talked about work and energy. And work has this phenomenally boring definition in physics that just is completely counterintuitive, I think. It is the force times the distance moved in the direction along that force. And it is counterintuitive biologically, because if you're a waiter and you're doing this all day long, your arm is really tired, and you sure as hell feel like you did a lot of work, right? But you're not actually doing work in the physics world because you're exerting a normal force on this tray of stuff this way, and you're moving at right angles to it. So you are not moving any distance along the direction of the force. This would be physics work. This would be negative physics work. Negative work is a cool idea. That also doesn't seem to work out very well in the real world. But in physics it works. So there's a very particular definition that we use for work in physics. And in fact, our whole definition of energy gets all tied up with this, which sort of sounds a bit crazy. Energy we can define as the ability to do work. And that may not make a lot of sense in some ways, and sometimes we have to do a bit of twisted example to sort of figure out how these two things tie together. But you'll see example after example of how this basically works. A way to think about it might be, if I exert a force through a distance, right, I can pick something up. The moment I pick it up, if I let it go, it can fall and smash something exerting a force through a distance. Right, so it can do work. So we say that I give it potential energy by exerting work on it. And we'll do some calculations, and you'll see that numerically, the energy that things get are correlated to the amount of work that we do. So in the end, it sort of works, but I think when you first see it, it sort of works. Sorry. It's an overworked word. In the end, you'll see that it makes a lot of sense once it all falls together. At any rate, the direction is incredibly important for the direction in which you go and the direction of the force. So you can either think of it, depending on how the problem is set up, if you have a point at which a force is exerted, some object, and it moves through some distance, then the amount of work you do is the force times the distance, but it's only the distance which is along the direction of the force, or the magnitude of the force along the direction of movement. So if I want to look at the magnitude of the force along the direction of movement, it would be this component of the force. And I would take this F cosine times D and multiply it by this distance F cosine theta and multiply it by the distance D to get the magnitude of the work. Or I could do it the other way, which is to take the magnitude of the force and look at the component of D, which is along that force, which also turns out to give you the cosine theta. So either way, you get F times D times the cosine theta. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. So work has energy units, so whenever you're doing a calculation or everything, you sometimes have to remind yourself of that. And in MKS, we use units of a joule. And since this is an MKS, and work you think of as force times distance, with worrying about the distance, the angle later, is going to be newtons, which is a newton, which is the force in MKS times distance. So a newton meter is a unit of work. This FD cosine theta, one of the things you have to always keep in mind is that is the angle between the two vectors if you put them tail to tail. Okay? So, that comes out of a certain type of vector multiplication, which we call the dot product, which I think I talked about last time. Sometimes it's also called the scalar product. Remember, vectors are not numbers. So we've talked about addition of vectors, and it was more complicated than the addition of numbers, because you have to worry about the direction. The same thing is true if you want to talk about multiplication of vectors. And in fact, you are going to run into two different ways of multiplying vectors. In fact, we'll do them both in Physics 113. The first one, and I think the one that's most easy to see conceptually, is this scalar dot product. We have said that work is equal to the force times the distance it goes along the direction of the force, or it is the distance times the component of the force along that direction. So it turns out that when you multiply vectors, there happens to be a mathematical operation, which we call the scalar product, which gives you exactly that. So if I have two vectors, like so, and I have set them up so they're tail to tail, and that's the opening angle between them, then we define the dot product, A dot B, as the magnitude of vector A times the magnitude of vector B times cosine theta, and that's equal to B dot A. So this is basically just what we did in the last page. It just gives you, it projects out either the component of B along A and multiplies it by A, or it projects out the component of A along B and multiplies it by B. And that's what you want with work. Once you have done this, you then have a number. It's a magnitude only. There is no direction to work or anything where you do a dot product. There is another way of calculating it, which is to take the x components and multiply them by each other, add it to the y components, multiply by each other, and add them to the b components, multiply by each other. So you will need to, basically, when you think dot product, sometimes you want to calculate it this way, sometimes you want to calculate it that way. Just depends on what you're given. We will see a different type of vector multiplication, which is called the cross product, in about another month. And we'll worry about that then. Any questions about the dot product? All right.
So if we want to look at work very generally, we can imagine that we have some coordinate system. And let's suppose that we have some object which at any given time has a force on it as a function of time. And let's say that this thing goes through a path that looks something like this as a function of time. And I'm going to define a point here as an initial point and a point here as a final point. And I want to know what is the work done on the object. Between point I and point F. So the way to think about that is to sort of blow this up . It's complicated because the path is changing and the force is changing. So we can't just say it's force times distance, even if I project the distance along the force, because the force may be changing with time, the distance may be changing with time, so it's a complicated thing. So what we have to do is to think of this motion only along a tiny, 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 tiny little portion of it. Because no matter how the curve is, if I look at a little tiny portion of it, it looks straight. I've got a small enough region. So what I'd like to do is to look at this particular problem where I'm only thinking of a little ds in length. And I'm going to say during that time, I have a displacement vector, that little tiny bit of time, I have a displacement vector, ds, that looks like so. If that time is short enough and ds is, you know, a differential of length, I don't have to worry about the curving, changing nature of this path. Okay? Now I have just a displacement vector, ds, at this very particular time. The force is whatever it is at that time, and I can do the dot product. If I want to find out what the force is from some point I, which is a long distance from some point F, I divide it up into umpteen trillion little ds's, and I do this dot product calculation at every one of those things, and I sum them up. And that's an integral. Right? So the work here for this little ds thing, I'm going to call it dw. So the differential work done along that little ds we know is equal to f dotted into ds. Right? That's by definition, basically. And now if I want to know how much work is done as I go from I to F, I sum up all these little differential ds's along the path. So it would be from point I to point F of F dot ds. And that's the integral that I want to do to know how much work it took to move from one point to another. You happy with that? All right, we'll do an example in a second. But I forgot to do a demo, so let me do this demo. Wake us up.
a simple block of wood. It's fairly smooth. The other side is covered with sandpaper. Okay? So, smooth side down. I have another block which has two smooth sides. Each block weighs a little bit more than 800 grams. Alright? I thought there was a string there. Okay. So now I have both blocks with smooth side down. And I have, this is basically called a spring balance. And all it really does is give you a measure of a force. Right, and it gives you some sort of picture. So this thing weighs, if I lift it up a little bit, then the force goes away. And you're not seeing a thing because that's spinning in a circle. You got the picture, I hope. So what I'm going to do, though, is to use this spring balance to be a measure of how much tension is in this rope. So I'm going to hold this up just so you can see it, but I'm basically going to pull until they're moving, and you see something like four. Okay? Now I'm going to do the same thing, but I'm going to turn this one over so that it has the rough side going. What do you think is going to happen? You now have the rough side, so mu sub k, because it's moving, will be a little bit larger. And so you would expect the tension to move it to have to be a little bit greater. And it's about six. It's exciting, right? Yeah. Now if you're really ready for some fun, watch this. I'm going to take this block and just put it on top of that block. Smooth side down. What do you think is going to happen? It's going to be about twice as heavy, but the surface is like we had the first time. The first time we measured four. Force of friction goes as mu times n. I've doubled n, but the surface is the same. Now I have the surface area we're dragging. So it's not exact, but let's see what happens. Well, we only got six. Sometimes it just doesn't work well. But you do have more because you now have a bigger normal surface, normal force. Okay. See if this works better. So now I'm going to do twice the weight, but I'm going to use the sandy side surface. Okay, it's a little bit more. Anyway, it sort of works.
Fortunately, you won't be doing practicals like that. You may do it in the lab, but in the lab, then things will be in a more controlled environment, and it'll work probably a bit better. Okay, so what I'd like to do is a simple example with work. And what you'll note is that you may think of work as force times distance. And it's okay to sort of think of it that way up to a point. But if things are changing or things are at angles, you have to put in that dot product. That said, you also need to bear in mind that as things change in these problems, this is really what you have to do, okay? Because you may have to worry about doing it point to point. So you really need to keep this tucked away in the back of your head. That said, if you look at most problems,
it turns out to be pretty simple, because either you are moving perpendicular to the force, in which case the dot product is zero, or you're moving with the force, in which case you just have force times distance. So in many, many, many problems that you do, you can sort of just think about it as force times distance, or zero, depending on which way you're going. Always keep this in the back of your mind, because they won't always be that simple. But
the first example I want to do is that simple. So let's imagine that you have a backpack and you climb up a cliff. So a climber goes up a cliff, a distance h, and that's meant to be a straight line, then traverses at right angles to a straight line going up, so traverses horizontally, and then comes down. And we'll say this is a distance d. And then the question is, this person who goes up the cliff has a backpack, and then the question is, what is the work done by the climber on the backpack in each segment of the climb? And what is the total work? Notice the wording is a little awkward, because the climber is doing work on the backpack. So let's think about that for a moment. On the first leg, so to do this problem, you have three natural pieces. I already sort of labeled them. In this piece, the climber is exerting a force up on the backpack, and the climber moves from the bottom up to the top of the cliff. So we have a distance and a fixed force during this time, so it's relatively easy to calculate the work there doing the second. Then we have this piece where the situation has fundamentally changed. You now are still holding the backpack up, where the climber is, but now you move a different way. So it is not easy to sort of couple that in with this, but as a standalone segment, it's easy to calculate. And then similarly, we have a situation where we're moving down, and you have a distance you go and a constant force. So it naturally breaks into these three segments. So what you want to do is to think of, for the total motion, the integral of f dot ds.
You have this awkward wording, which is, what is the work done on the backpack? If you think about it, if you're holding the backpack, you're exerting a force upward on the backpack, otherwise it crashes to the ground because it's got that mg on it, right? Due to gravity. It exerts a force on you, which is down, right? Because if you're pulling it up, it's pulling you down. Action, reaction, force pair. So this force F, it's the same magnitude. I'm lifting the backpack up, it has got a force on me, which is the same magnitude but opposite direction. So it is important to know whether you're talking about the work done by me on the backpack or the work done by the backpack on me. They'll turn out to have the same magnitude, but opposite the sign. So All work problems will have a very particular weird sort of wording, which is what is the work done by this on that? And that is really important because you have to sort of know what direction the force is that you're talking about. So in this case, I say, what is the work done by the climber on the backpack? This force, this F, the direction of this F, is the force exerted on the backpack by the climber. Okay? So, a little bit of a subtlety. But we're going to go from... So this integral is over the entire path. So we're going to break it up into three different pieces. We're going to break it up into segment 1 plus segment 2 plus segment 3. And I know to do that because these three segments break down naturally in terms of having a constant force over that particular segment. So that means these three things are going to each be individually evaluated in somewhat different ways. At every given moment, here's my backpack, the climber exerts a force on it, and I have mg down. That is the free body diagram of the backpack. And if I were making this problem out on an exam, I would probably say something like, the climber moves at a constant rate. That's the hell of a climber, right? Going at a constant rate up the cliff. Why do I do that? If I don't, you have a thought?
It would be zero. The force and gravity would be equal.
Why do you think they'll be equal?
The backpack isn't falling or going up.
Because the acceleration is zero. Yeah, that's exactly it. If it's just arbitrary motion, you could have some Superman climber accelerating up the cliff. In which case, you have an imbalance between this force and mg. And then I don't know what to tell you. It's not a constant force, and now I have a real integral to do here. I may not even know the magnitude is f unless I tell it to you, right? Because if the f is huge, then it accelerates like a rocket, right? That's crazy. So often in this kind of thing, there will be wording which will sort of let you know that you don't need to worry about that kind of complication. So in this case, I might tell you the climber is climbing at a constant rate up and then moves at a constant rate over and then moves at a constant rate down. That tells you that the acceleration in those directions is zero, which means, for example, F equals mg all the way up the cliff. Of course that's crap. In the real world, they start at velocity zero, then they move a little bit, then they stop, and they move a little bit, but don't worry about that. That's the real world. You're definitely not in the real world here. Right? So we want to be able to equate these two because I tell you that the acceleration is zero. So for the first leg, here, I have F goes up, mg is down, the magnitude of F is equal to mg, ds is a little vector that's going up. So F dot ds, if the dot product is between two vectors and theta is 0, cosine theta is 1. So you have a positive 1. That is, the force is entirely in the direction of ds. So you're just multiplying f times ds. So f dot ds becomes the magnitude of f times the magnitude of ds. So this integral here, number 1, is equal to the integral of the constant f times ds over this distance from 0 to h, actually. F is equal to mg, so it's just mg times h, and it's positive.
For this one, what is f dot ds?
Moving from here to here, what do you think f dot ds would be? I support the backpack. My force is up. I move this way. What's the dot product between f and ds? It's zero. They're right angles to each other. There is no component of this vector along this vector. There's no component of this vector along that vector. So it may wear you out as a climber, but that's biological work. That's not what we're calling work here. Okay, so from the point of view of classic mechanical work, this is zero because f is perpendicular to ds.
So when I do this little symbol, I mean perpendicular to. Okay, what about for the third piece?
You are not accelerating. So as you go down, you are constantly supporting the backpack. Even though you're going down, your force on the backpack is up. Because if it were not up, you would have an unbalanced MG and the backpack would just fall to the ground. Right? So think of it as if you have a bucket that you're holding and I say put it on the floor. Even though you move down, you are constantly having to exert a force up to keep it from crashing to the ground. Okay? So F and MG constantly cancel each other out if the acceleration downward is zero. Yes, it's an approximation because you know at the very top you're not moving and then you're accelerating downward a little before you can move. That is sort of an edge effect that you want to ignore in problems like this. Get too tangled up on those, you're going to get really twisted in knots. So here, the force is going to be up. DS, now, you're going down. So now you have F and DS. F dot ds is the magnitude of f times the magnitude of ds times the cosine theta. Now, theta is 180 degrees. The cosine of 180 degrees, or the cosine of pi, is minus 1. So because you are exerting a force opposite the direction that you're moving, the work is negative. Okay? So in this case, it's really the same as what we had initially. You're going from it's equal to minus mgh. So if we look at the total path, we get mgh, positive mgh for the going up, plus zero for the traverse, plus a minus mgh for going down. So the total work done is zero, even though you're sort of worn out. Yeah. Okay, any questions on that? So it may seem a little bit strange that this total work is zero. And it turns out it's because gravity exhibits a very particular characteristic. As far as gravity is concerned, you start out at a certain height and you come back to that same height. So
the net change in height is zero.
And it turns out that the potential energy that this object has only depends on how high it is, right? If I have a lead brick and I have it on the floor, it hasn't got the potential to do work in smashing my toe. If I lift it up, it has potential to do work and smash my toe, because if I happen to drop it, if it's on my toe, it's going to smash it. If I lift it up higher, it has more of the potential to do that nasty work of smashing my toe. Okay? So the higher I lift it, the more potential it has. So we say that there's sort of this equivalence between the work that I do and the amount of energy, potential energy, that I give this thing. When you have this sort of one-to-one mapping between the work that I do and the potential energy that you have, if it's very simple, it only depends on the endpoints. If I take this brick and I put it back down on the floor, it no longer has that potential energy. And I can do all sorts of work on this thing all day long, and so long as I end up back at the same place, there's no net energy flow to that brick from the gravity. Okay? So the net change in the height is zero for this entire motion, there's no net energy flow through this system. And we say that, and we calculate the net work is zero, which is another way of saying that. And if you have a system which basically only depends on the endpoints like that, that if you come back to the same point, you'll have the same energy, that system is called a conservative system. And a force that exhibits this, we call a conservative force. And I'll be coming back to this a lot, and it will become more clear what I really mean as I refer to it. But it turns out that gravitation works this way. Springs, to a large extent, work this way. Electromagnetism works this way, so you'll see it. And these are going to be three of the primary systems you're going to study through the whole course. Not everything is completely conservative. If you have friction in the system, for example, then this makes a difference. Imagine that I have climb up the cliff, and then I drag the backpack along, and there's friction involved, and then I go down the cliff. Now, as I drag the backpack, I'm having to exert a force against friction, so I have some non-zero force, some non-zero work that I do to drag the thing along. That energy gets lost to heat through friction, and now when I go back down the cliff, even though I come to the same height, I have to exert some net work, right? I have a positive work going up, negative work going down. Those two cancel out, but I have this net work that I lose to friction. So in a conservative system which doesn't involve friction, the energy flow is pretty easy to visualize. So that's one of the reasons we're going to do a whole lot. I mean, I hope it will become clear, if it's not already, that the game in physics is to try to simplify the system to where we can sort of understand the essence of what's going on, and try not to get too hung up on the details. You don't want to do that if you're actually building a bridge. You take your understanding of stuff, and then you have to make sure that you got all the details worked out so that the bridge doesn't fall down. So in the real world, it's more complicated. But we can sort of get at the essence of things this way. So the conservative system is very important to us because it allows us to really understand things by energy flow. All right, so let me do another example that gives you a little bit of a feeling about energy. Suppose that you're pushing a cart on a flat surface
and you go a distance D. So we want to start from rest. Let's say that it is frictionless system. And let's examine the motion a little bit. We know that, let's say that we exert a force F this way. So we know that F equals MA. And we know that the work in this case, if we say it's a constant force F, we say we start from rest, no friction, constant force, go in one direction. So the work is going to be equal to F times the distance D that you go. If it's a constant F, it's constant A. So that means I can use a constant A equation. So if you recall those, V squared is equal to V0 squared plus 2 times A times the distance you go, which is D. V0 is 0. So we get V squared is equal to 2 times A times the distance. The acceleration, F equals MA, so the acceleration is F over M. So this is 2 times F over M times D. F times D is the work. So we have that the work is equal to M times V squared divided by 2. So in this simple system, we've calculated what the work is. We know that work is what we can do to imbue a system with energy. But now, the kind of energy that we've given this thing is sort of the energy of motion. If you want to think about it, remember, energy is the ability to do work. If I get this cart and I shove it and it's going really, really fast, as it's going, it can exert a force through a distance, so it can do work on something else. So by doing work on it, I give it energy, it now can do work on other things. And the energy that we give it is sort of an energy of motion, which, we look at this simple example, takes a form, which is 1/2 mv². And it makes some sense. If this cart is heavy and going a certain velocity, it will squish me more if it's heavier. If it's going faster, it'll squish me more. So in a sense, you can measure its potential to do work by this. I mean, I hope it makes some intuitive sense that it will depend on the mass and the velocity. I don't know that it should make intuitive sense that it depends on velocity squared, but hopefully this derivation isn't crazy for you. So it turns out that this energy of motion we call the kinetic energy. And it takes the form, we define it as 1/2 mv². So whenever you hear something has a motion, you know that it inherently has a certain amount of energy, which is 1/2 mv². Any questions on this stuff? Let me stop there with the lecture. Let's talk about the test. See is the basic spread. This is on the web right now. So this is the number of students and versus grade, and the binning is there are 100 bins on a scale from 0 to 100. Just remember that
basically I'm going to take the mean and put it up here so that numerically, I'm going to put this grade on Blackboard, but then I'm going to numerically move them all up so that the mean is basically at 100. So this whole curve moves, so something like this point is going to be up at 100. So you'll have another column, which will be the rescaled grade, and that's the one I'll use in the final grade calculation, okay, for the renormalization. That said, that's sort of irrelevant to today. Today, what you want to do is to look at the spread and let me sort of give you a sense of what's going on. Remember that if I make the exam too easy, it's deceptive and I have a hard time sort of understanding who's understanding subtleties and who's not. If I make it too hard, then I really have a hard time understanding who's not sort of getting it with decent study skills, not studying it the right way. This one, actually, I'm completely happy with in terms of how the exam went. I heard from the TAs that there were about 20% of you left. Anecdotally, I find if I blow the exam and I have an impossible problem on it or I have too many problems on it, that there's about 50% or more of you left. So that's when the class usually is very frustrated by it. I'm not saying none of you were frustrated by this. I'm just saying that in terms of the global thing. Usually when I have about as many left as last time on this exam, it meant the timing of the exam was actually okay, which meant most of you had the opportunity to take your crack at all of the problems, which is really what I'm trying to design. So as far as I know, the exam itself was about right. The curve is about what I was aiming for. And one of the reasons it may have struck you as sort of a hard exam was because we pushed to get some of Newton's laws in there. And I do that for a strong reason right now, because I want to expose any issues you have with study, how you're approaching this class, I want to expose those problems now, because now is the time you have to fix them. And I find if we, you know, if I make the first exam a little easier, if we didn't put Newton's laws on there, then some of you will have real study issues with this class and not really realize it. And then you get to exam two, a lot more material, and then you're in trouble. Okay, so what to take out of this? First of all, if you had a bad day, the syllabus allows for it. I mean, from terms of how the syllabus works, you can have no water under the bridge at all at this point, except for a few problems. But you can effectively drop this one. So that's the good news, if it didn't go so well for you. The news you really have to watch out for is, generally speaking, the grade you will get on the next test is best indicated by the grade you got on this test. I don't mean that to come out discouraging like it may to some of you. The real message in that is that's what happens if you don't do anything different. So this test, you want to look at how you did, analyze how you did by looking at the solution set and trying to figure out what you missed, think about how you studied, this type of stuff. And if you think you need to make a change, you need to make the change now. Because the next test, even if you want to drop this one, the next test totally counts. And it won't do you any good to make the change whenever. I can't begin to tell you, every semester I get somebody who's coming in 3 days before the final wondering what's broken and how they're studying the class. And I can't do anything for you at that point. So you've got to look at it now. In terms of how you should interpret your grade when you see it, remember, the number in and of itself is not so important. So if you have a 70, that doesn't mean it's a D or a C or whatever you may be used to from some other class or high school or whatever. You want to look at it relative to this, because I think things were pretty normal, and so to speak, in this class. When I look at this distribution, I sort of think of it as a Gaussian curve, roughly, with a long downside tail. And the way that I would interpret it, depending on where your grade is clearly if you are up here, you're basically getting everything that I want you to get. You may have made a mistake or two, Okay, that's fine. You're going to make mistakes on tests, but basically, you're doing great. Whatever it is you're doing in terms of your study habits for this class, it seems to be working, and my advice to you is just stick with it. You're doing fine. If you're in here, you need to look at the exam solutions and think a little bit about what kinds of stuff you miss. Basically, you're getting it. You're doing well. People here in the middle are, you know, in this class are sort of aiming at a B in terms of numerical grades, if that's what you're interested in. The message, is, the numerical grade you still want to worry about right now, what you want to worry about is the message. You want to think about what being down here means in terms of how you performed on the test if you want to do better on the test. Did you make a bunch of silly errors? Or did you do basically well on the things that you studied well, and then you had one or two holes that just went right by you? Okay? If you're in the latter case, you need to think about, look at the homework sets, look at the workshops, think about how you study, and figure out systematically how to plug those holes. Because basically you're doing great, but you just let a couple of things go by you. If you're making a lot of silly mistakes, that's a little bit of a harder thing to fix, but then you need to think about a lot of things. Are you making those silly mistakes typically in workshop and homework so that you're just sort of careless, try to be less careless, or is it more associated with a test-taking issue, in which case you want to think about the nature of that? And I don't have any great advice because it tends to be a personal thing, so you have to think about that. But, you know, so the holes, in some sense, are more serious to me than the silly errors. But don't expect perfection. It's hard. Everybody's trying to make some errors. But you do want to look at the solution set. You learn a whole lot by looking at the solution set in terms of how you're doing. If you're down here, usually to me, it means you're missing some very important parts of what I'm trying to teach you. And if you're down here, I pretty much am telling you you've got some holes. So things are getting past you. It's not a matter of making some silly mistakes. There are likely to be some fairly glaring problems in your understanding. It's very important to sort of figure that out and fix it now, because we're basically going to build on everything we've been doing. So you want to, if you do have a glaring hole on what we did, you want to sort of begin to fix it now. If you're down in here, something's really very broken. I can't answer for you what it is. You have to think about what is going on in your life, okay? You're not studying because you're putting all your time in on biochemistry. You found a new girlfriend. I don't know what it is, okay? More power to you, but this indicates you got massive holes going on. So if you're not doing the homeworks or you're having a friend do them for you, you need to change that, okay? So you want to think hard about what's going right and what's going wrong. Now, I absolutely know that there's some students in here who are working very hard and think they're doing everything right. And I'll give you one example of a student who came to me after a couple of tests and was getting their clock cleaned on the test. And I probably told you this already, but we had a conversation. How are you studying? And they said, well, do you read the chapters? Yeah, I read them 7 times. But wow, that's pretty impressive. 7 times takes a lot of time. I said, what are you doing on the homework? Well, I figure after your lectures, they seem to make sense. I read the chapter 7 times. It seems to make sense. You know, I got it. No, you're not getting it. I don't have time to do the homework then. That's easy to fix, right? Read the chapter once and do all the homework problems. And that one, was easy to fix. So think about how you're studying. I'm happy to talk to you about it once you've looked at the solutions and done this analysis of yourself. But those are the kinds of questions that I'll come at you with. In terms of regrades, okay? The regrades are such that I'm happy to look at problems that you think were not graded appropriately. We do give partial credit, so there's judgment call that TAs have to do, okay? I absolutely want you to spend time looking at the solution and try to figure out the solution first. Because until you've done that, you really have no way of judging whether the grading is inappropriate or not. Every exam I've ever been part of, regardless of how great the TAs are, there are problems that need to be regraded appropriately. And I will just give you the credit when I look at those. That said, It's not automatic. I do look at it carefully. I don't want frivolous requests. So you need to do your homework first and think about it before you ask for it. What I want you to do is to write what you want me to look at on the exam and then put it in my mailbox, or you can hand it to me after class or whatever. But you want to do your homework first and then I'll look at it. We will fix it. So if you have something that is glaringly wrong, don't get upset about it. We will fix it. Mistakes do happen. It happens on every test. It doesn't happen at the 50% level, though. Okay, so, but I can guarantee you there'll be a few of you that will have some issues.
So I will hand these back. I would like to ask, they're in envelopes with a sticker on it. I would like to ask that you actually just take the exam out of the envelope and leave the envelope for us, because we'll reuse those. Any questions about this? Okay, the solutions are on the exam, on the website. So here is A through J last name. Here is J through B.
Outside my office. If you can't pick it up now, you'll find them there.
Yeah, but actually.